You want to move off in the middle?
Yeah, just get me a shot. Maybe 5, 8:30 in the House Resource Committee Room in the Capitol Building. For the record, I'd like to note that the people present are Representative Miller, Representative Thompson, Representative Sun, Representative Drew Pierce, Representative Cato, Representative Schultz, and myself, Representative Herman. No clowning around, please. First of all, before we talk about HJR 8 and House Bill 7, HJR 8 is relating to the allocation of Gulf of Alaska Sable Fish Harvest by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I see that the sponsor is here, but first of all, I'd like to note that in this committee, sorry, Representative Jenkins is present. I'd like to note that on these kind of resolutions and things, that they might seem real simple, but they get real complicated because there are a lot of user groups, and we'll try to remember that that this is just a simple resolution asking the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council to do certain things, and we don't want to get off on different agendas here, but we want to keep to the resolution. And like last year in the first committee on fisheries, we had the halibut moratorium, and something that benefits me will, you know, might hurt Representative Thompson's district and those kind of things. So I think the special committee worked on this resolution and brought into consideration many people's concerns or problems with the resolution. And then we'll go from there and work on the resolution today. If we could get the sponsor, Representative Gusenberg, to testify.
Madam Chairman, I don't want to take the speaker, but just for the benefit of the committee here, so that we start out the year right, I have procured a sample of a frozen sablefish so that the committee may view what we're talking about, and I've also supplied some processed sablefish for the committee. This is smoked black cod, and if you'd like to taste a little bit as we go along, I'm sure that nobody would welcome that, but this is the creature we're talking about today that comes out of the deep blue sea. And a lot of it comes from Representative Thompson's district.
You just take a little bit of that and you put it in your gum there?
Yes, sir.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, the joint resolution 8 is dealing with black cod or sable fish, and this has been a traditional fisheries in Alaska and basically has been a hook and line fisheries. And when we look at the Magnuson Act, we see that the purpose of the Magnuson Act was to encourage the maximum utilization of those fishing species that benefit the American fishermen. And this is one that America has targeted on very heavily. We have several parts to this resolution that I'm sure that you've been able to see. I noticed the person that gives you backup here, Janet DeFries, has presented some very excellent historical background, so I won't go into that.
Excuse me for 1 minute. We did incorporate some of the special committee on fisheries. Their information into the resolution, and we came up with a CS. And if we could put the CS on the table, then we could go from there and talk about that. So, yeah.
Yes, Madam Chairman, yeah, that's what I'm working off from, the CS.
I would move that we adopt the committee substitute for House Joint Resolution Number 8.
Any objections? Hearing none, so moved.
One of the things that we have to consider, and the Magnuson Act points it out, is the economic impact upon the American fisheries. And this is a fisheries that has been utilized by Alaskans, and we have had a series of problems that have occurred, and you would probably be able to track that historically. One of the problems that we have is that there are gear conflicts, and the gear conflicts oftentimes occur between basically the smaller fishermen and the larger fishermen. And our concern in the southeast area here, or the eastern regulatory area, is the pot fisheries. One of the unfortunate things is the pot fisheries always has an incidental loss of pots and they make the grounds practically unusable by a long liner. So we have areas in the southeast that the longline fishermen cannot fish in now because there have been, you know, lost pots in there. The size of the line just cannot handle the pots, and that takes care of the longliner fishermen. And there's been some indication by the council that they saw this problem and went to and basically accepted Amendment 12, but did not put it into force. And now we're back to the point where they're talking about opening that back up again. And the difference between a lot of the other gear groups other than longliners is most of these people actually do a lot of processing right aboard their vessel and does not touch a shore base. While economically, in the smaller areas that have fishing communities, the longliners is the backbone of the fishing industry. And we're talking about millions of dollars in product. And also this, you know, shows up into the raw fish tax as well. And I'm going to speak basically in generalities because there are several people here that are very knowledgeable in the black cod fishing industry. And I see that they have signed up on this. And at this time, Madam Chairman, would be available for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. For the record, I'd like to know the arrival of Mr. Wallace. Are there any questions of the responses?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
I'd like to call Ron Cady of
Okay, my name is Ron Hagee. I'm from Sitka. I represent the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, which is an association of fishermen throughout Oregon, Washington, California, and Alaska, who basically fish with longline gear off Alaska's waters. I guess we probably are the originator of this House bill that you have, and we're very appreciative that you've taken it up. I'm not really sure how much to go into detail, except to say that it's very, very critical to Alaska that we do adopt this type of a resolution. Right now we have, off of Sitka, a 145-foot flatboat that is processing on board. None of the fish that he catch will come back to Sitka or Pelican or Petersburg or any of the ports that normally would depend on that product. He will also preempt, by whatever he catches, the some 90 fishermen that normally fish out of these ports for black cod. This is going to have a tremendous impact on our fishermen, upon our towns, and I think probably upon the future of how the fisheries are managed as far as, the Alaskan ports. Mr. Gusendorf mentioned the priority that's given to the Alaskan dependent communities in the Magnuson Act. And I guess this is, in essence, what you're drawing attention to by this resolution, that you do wish this priority to be given to the Alaskan ports, and that the importance of their resource be recognized. The two aspects of the resolution, the North Pacific Council in the December meeting had a motion that would allocate 10% of the total Gulf Sablefish OOI to the joint venture fishermen. We protested that very strongly on a number of grounds. First, that it was an allocation. Second, that it was based upon a percentage of the OOI, which fluctuates. And we asked that the council reconsider this, that the National Marine Fisheries Service reconsider this, that they not put it into effect, and that they return it to the council. We recognize the need of joint ventures to have a incidental bycatch. It is necessary. They do catch a certain amount of sablefish, PLP, and rockfish in their target fisheries. We would, however, ask that the council base the amount that they set aside for this bycatch on the actual needs of the fisheries. There's certainly already background data on just what they do catch. National Marine Fisheries Service supplied me in September, which is well into the season, that the the bycatch of the joint ventures in 1984 had been roughly 470 tons in the central and western Gulf. I didn't bring the exact figures with me, but the effort after that time wasn't all that great. Generally, in the discussions that I have with the joint venture people, we're talking in the neighborhood of 500 tons. The wording of the, excuse me.
Madam Chairman? On that, in terms of the set-aside or whatever for the incidental catch of sable fish, what's your opinion on, say, putting just a flat number in there, just a fixed tonnage number versus a percentage of the OY?
I think that that's a very critical part of it. We can establish, and certainly through work committees that would be ongoing, which was done by the council, we can establish the needs of the ventures so that we can supply them with what they actually need as an incidental bycatch to operate. However, anything that is based on a percentage of OY becomes an allocation of the portion of the OY as the optimum yield that is designated to be caught. It actually designates a portion of that fish that would be given just to them and would become inaccessible by any other gear group. It has nothing to do with what their actual needs might be.
Madam Chairman? Just follow through. So the wording in the resolution now says based on actual needs, which would leave it up to the council to determine what that need is on a year-by-year basis. Are you comfortable with that, or would you rather have a set tonnage, 480 tons or 500 tons, put in the resolution?
I suggested this one that says set aside reserves to allow incidental catch of sable fish based on actual need rather than optimum yield. That was our suggestion, and I think in this area they would establish a minimum tonnage that was needed to allow the joint ventures to continue and would set that amount.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question that might show. I know about pots for crab fishery and stuff like that. Do they use the same type of pot and catch sable fish in those pots? And I'm trying to figure out how that's done. Or do they have a different type of pot that's used?
They have a different type of pot. I wish there was a blackboard in here. There are two types of pots that are used in the sable fish fishery. One is a cone pot. Let's see if I could take that plate there. I think I can show you. It's kind of a
very good idea.
A cone pot has a configuration almost like this. There's web that goes down all the way around it. And these are fished on a long line, very heavy rope. There would be maybe 50, 60 of them on one line, 40 or 50 fathoms. It would be 300 some feet apart, maybe strung along the bottom. There's a conical entrance that has a little opening on the end. It's what they call the tunnel. The fish go in the conical entrance. Once inside, they go around the pot, but it's very difficult for them to go back out. The other type of pot that is sometimes used is very similar to a crab pot. It's large, rectangular, uses the same tunnel, conical opening. And they again are fished on a long line, stretched along the bottom.
Yeah, we could follow up on the same question. Do they put a dissolvable section in there like they do with the king crab pots now, so that if the pot is lost, does it ever stop fishing or does it fall apart at all?
Well, there is a regulation on the records. However, it's very ineffective. The regulation states that they have a biodegradable panel, which is made by sewing a mesh of cotton twine into the meshes. And the panel must equal the tunnel opening. In other words, the conical opening coming down, if it opens this wide, then they must have a panel in there this wide. On the surface, that might seem okay because you would think that a fish that got in could get out. However, you must remember that a fish going in is guided in by the tunnel opening. A fish that's in there sees very little because of the light at that depth. And black cod, particularly, are very predatory fish, and a fish in there might be being chased by another one looking for this exit. To find it without being able to see that much is very, very unlikely. The other aspect of it is that this twine takes a long time to dissolve at those depths. I have the same twine on my crab pots, which is required. The twine that I have on there now has been on for over 18 months without a single bit of breakage.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, if I could, please. On the allocation to the joint ventures, we would agree very much with this as it is printed here, allowing the joint ventures and incidental catch that does relate to the need that actually exists for them to continue. Speaking briefly to the other part, the hook and line, if you recall my description of the pots, I think that if you compare that to the line that is used by longline fishermen, which is quarter inch or 5/16 line, very light in nature, it has very little chance when the two types of gear meet in the ocean. The pot fisherman completely preempts the longline fisherman from an area while they're fishing, and the lost gear that he leaves in the ocean continues to hurt us after he has long since left the area. We had a boat, the Billy Don, fishing there some 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, who lost a substantial amount of gear, and to this day fishermen are losing gear on it, and large areas of the coast off Sitka are inaccessible to us because of that gear. The gear also did not have escape panels, so it's probably still down there killing fish, because as fish go in, they become food for other fish and bait. And pots continue to work. The other aspect that Mr. Grissendorf mentioned is that the freezer boats generally, or the pot boats generally, that we're seeing are offshore processors. They freeze and process the fish on board, and it never comes to the coastal communities. The plants throughout Southeast Alaska, the processors, have all expressed a great concern in this bill, because they have all become very dependent on the fish. They become very dependent on the type of fish that the longliners deliver. They have developed their markets around this fish. To make the entrance of another gear type that would cause gear conflicts and possibly preempt them from getting the fish at all would be a very detrimental effect upon our communities. I've talked to ports all the way from Kodiak on down. A number of fishermen in Kodiak do support this very strongly, as I'm sure that there are some that don't. However, I think it has somewhat of an overriding effect that we have a concern for the communities. The fishermen that would oppose it generally are those who would not necessarily be delivering into the communities. And the fishermen that do support it, who make up substantially the entire fleet that is now harvesting the fish, are bringing the fish back into the communities, whether they live there or not. They're at least contributing greatly to Alaska's economic well-being.
On that question there, what percentage of the total OY is taken by longline now versus the percentage taken by pots?
By area in Eastern Gulf, which is the area that we're talking about on this resolution, I think it was roughly 97%. That's the information given to me by the Fish and Game on their landing showed about 200,000 pounds being landed by pots in the Eastern Gulf out of a quota of, I think it was 3,000 tons, which is substantial.
And this has been a traditional area of longlining in the Eastern Gulf, though. I mean, can you recall when pots first started being used in the area?
There have been several attempts that are very short-lived. They've been unsuccessful. I think the Billy Don was the first. I think it was about 1978 or 80 that he was in there, and he ended up losing all of his gear and leaving out. A number of people have tried from time to time since, but their success rate is so low because of the type of currents that we get in the bottom configuration that it hasn't been a profitable thing for them. Been very unprofitable for the rest of us.
Did you mention in your testimony that the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council did deal with the issue, but then they put in an amendment and they just overlooked it or whatever they did? Did you?
Mr. Grissendorf referred to it, but yes, in 1982, Alpha, before I was there, did present this to the North Pacific Council. It was passed by the council, and from there, it went on into public testimony and public hearings, which is part of the process that it must go through. After that time, the package was prepared by the council staff to be sent on through the National Marine Fisheries Service, and it was sent for, as I am told, it was sent for an informal review here to Juneau to the National Marine Fisheries Service. At that time, they found several things that were structurally wrong with the proposal, and they sent it back. It was not ever resubmitted, and more or less sat for 2 years until this last summer, when the director asked that it be brought up again before the council and restudied, and then give a determination whether they want to continue with it or drop it, or what would be, you know, their desire. At that time, the council expanded it to Gulf-wide and sent it back to the staff for working to be resubmitted to the ground fish plan here in February.
What is the eastern regulatory area?
The eastern Gulf is the area east of 147 degrees latitude.
Could we get, Madam Chairman, could we have the staff basically point out where east, where 147 is on the map?
Excuse me, longitude.
Longitude.
We've got the map.
Okay, that's...
Oh, here's...
Okay.
Yeah, I can just supply that for us if you want to show it.
I think there's a map in the packet. I just wanted to... Thank you, Madam Chairman. I did want to take that one step further on Amendment 12 and the suggestion that the eastern area would be exclusive for a long line. That Amendment 12 of 140, not east of 147. And that was only a portion of the eastern regulatory area. I would also point out there's been an amendment from John Mayer of the Independent Fishermen of Alaska, which I understand will be presented at the CITCA meeting of the MPFMC, requesting again that the exclusive hook and line area east of 140 for harvesting of sablefish. But in my mind, anyway, I hope we have the differences of opinion over what's the most prudent line of demarcation within the eastern area resolve, recognizing that the final decision is not going to be made by this group or even the House in general, but rather by the MPFMC or in turn by the larger MF, NMFS. So I really don't think it's worth our time to quibble over 140 or 147. I would like to get back to something you said, Madam Chairman, at the beginning of this meeting, and this has been a real learning experience for me in going through this process here, that nothing is as simple as it first seems. Whenever I get into a situation like this where my information leads me to what I believe to be a logical conclusion, I'm oftentimes at a mystery to me to understand another's point of view. I'm often reminded of the young boy who wanted to go fishing at his favorite fishing hole and so he packed up his tackle box and headed out to go fishing, and he got to the favorite spot and the owner had erected a sign that said, "Private pond, no fishing allowed." And the boy studied the sign a minute, thought about it, walked past it, opened up his tackle box, and started fishing. Shortly thereafter, the owner of the pond came along, and upon seeing the boy was somewhat upset, he approached him and said, "Didn't you see this sign?" The boy said, "Sure." He said, "Well, what did it say?" The kid looked at it again and said, "Private pond? No. Fishing allowed." And I think of that story whenever I am hard-pressed to understand another's point of view and how two people could look at seemingly the same information and come to different conclusions. And I think that this kind of thing is a good example of that. And the moral of the story, of course, is that we can all learn from one another if we take the time to find out how the other one read the signs along the way. In Kodiak's case, one of the challenges in representing my district is that it is a very complex district. We have longliners, indeed a great number of them. We have pot fishermen, we have draggers. And that makes my position a very difficult one in trying to represent all the diverse interests of the Kodiak fleet. I am very pleased with the work that Representatives Grisendorf and Herman and Gall have done in working with me in trying to satisfy the concerns of the Kodiak fleet in this matter, and their respective staffs have done an excellent job here. And I am very satisfied with the committee substitute, and at this point do not have any further problems with the amendments that are suggested in it. And I base that on a number of considerations. Quite frankly, I'm going to take my lumps from a certain segment of my constituency regardless of what we do. That comes with the territory. I accept that. I try to make my decisions in what I feel the best interest of not only District 27, but rather the larger Alaskan interest as a whole. In this case, we're talking about a fishing industry which is in some trouble and needs for us to be as supportive as possible. Yesterday in the Special Fisheries Committee, we worked on some alternative language which we thought at the time might perhaps be a better way to go. But this is the culmination of a couple of weeks' worth of effort on all parties involved, and I am satisfied with the language that I see here. There was one point that I would like to make in the original draft, which I guess Ben left on. I just would like to point out for the sake of the issues that will come before us in the days ahead, and that is we need to be very sensitive to the constitutional questions in developing things of this nature, not afoul of the Constitution. The original language has suggested that the exclusive fishery be established for Alaskan fishermen, and that's always a problem, as we know from longevity bonuses and things of that nature. We have to be sensitive to the fact that we can't restrict it just to Alaskan fishermen. We have to speak in terms, a generic term, fishermen in general. Of course, I think we all recognize that we hope that there are Alaskan fishermen, but we have to be sensitive to that kind of consideration. So the long and the short of it for me here today is that I am prepared to support the committee substitute. And again, I just want to thank everyone for their efforts over the last few weeks in trying to work out these differences. And I thank you for coming today and giving us the benefit of your testimony.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, giving a message to the Fisheries Management Council, how we feel, and I think it definitely does support our Alaskan community.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, as long as we're laying things on the table here, I'd slipped my mind at the beginning, but I have a statement I made last year and this year that I will expose any direct or indirect conflicts that may come before here, and I guess there's one laying around here right now, but the... comment on the Alaska fishermen versus non-Alaskan fishermen, the point of view I take is that if we do have several ways which we can decide how to manage our fisheries, one of which tends to favor the residents of Alaska versus the non-residents, and it gets through the constitutional issues, I obviously hope that we would set up a management scheme that would enhance our Alaskan fishermen, and that leads into we obviously benefit much more by onshore processing than offshore processing of our resources. And in this case here, almost exclusive of the longline fishery is processed onshore, where a lot of the pot fishery is processed on board the boat frozen, and it leaves the state, well, these aren't even in state waters. We're fishing outside the state waters, and there's very little benefit to the state of Alaska out of it. So I don't think it's a constitutional issue. It's a management structure issue. And I guess I get into the conflict there because I am a part owner of an onshore-based processing plant that processes sable fish, and to the degree that these fish come ashore, I guess I have some benefit from that. But I hope it's not much more than the general benefit that everybody has out of this. So I guess I will agree with what's come out of the Fisheries Committee, but I would like to see an exclusive longline fishery across the Gulf and not just in the eastern regulatory area. But perhaps, Mr. Eady, you could comment on that. I think that what's happening in the council now is that they're trying to get an emergency order to make the eastern regulatory area exclusive, and then they're working through a process to make the entire Gulf longline fishery through the amendment process. Is that what's happening now?
Yes, that's correct. I asked the council to put on the agenda at the February meeting an emergency amendment to vote on that would designate the Eastern Gulf 147 degrees as hook and line only. In reference to your comment on 140, 140 was established because of a split in the Eastern Gulf that at the time that was done, the foreign fishing occurred west of that area and it was the area of prime fishing. The natural place to pick for a boundary is the Eastern Gulf with 147 degrees. In talking to the various people involved, I understand that the designation 140 is probably going to be completely off the record here in a few years since it uses very little purpose. And the Eastern, Central, and Western Gulf boundaries are the logical points of marking.
Depends whose logic it is.
Pardon?
That depends whose logic.
Yeah, well, they're marks that will continue to be used in the management process. In answer to your question, there is a proposal from a Seattle group for the entire Gulf to be hook and line only. There's another proposal making the entire Alaskan waters hook and line only. All of these will be considered by the council. The reason for our emergency is that the coastal communities in this area east of 147 are so extremely dependent upon the traditional longline fishery. The makeup of the ground in this area, the shelf is so narrow there, the two fisheries cannot operate together. And the longline fishermen, whether they be from whatever state, would be completely preempted from the grounds if an intensive pot fishery did exist there.
Madam Chairman, it just triggered another point here. We're talking about east of 147, which looked like a lot of water, but in fact the fishing area that you just referred to is quite narrow. That goes from, what, Dixon entrance on up. I don't know, how wide a band are we talking about in terms of miles?
It varies down the fathom curve that we usually fish on is from 300 to 500 fathoms, and off of southeast it can be less than half a mile in many instances, the grounds you would fish. Longliners can't fish side by side. Pot fishermen and longliners certainly can't even fish close to each other.
I think a lot of these concerns will be addressed by the North Sea Management Council once it comes before them, and Western Wisconsin will be fascinating, and we'll keep track.
I just would like to respond very quickly to Representative Sun's choice of words a moment ago. He suggested that the way to for us to get around any problems with Alaskan fishermen versus the generic term fisherman is to have a, quote, management scheme that assisted the Alaskan fishermen. And I would just like to say that I'm big on words, and semantics sometimes are very telling. Plans I'll go along with, schemes I won't.
Yes. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Larry Cotter to testify, please. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Larry Cotter. I'm the president of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union in Alaska. We represent seafood processing workers, among other groups in different areas of the state. Testifying in support of the committee substitute, attempt to be brief, and just reiterate the point that has already been made that the sable fish catch as provided through the longline fishery yields abundant employment opportunities and income to not only seafood processing workers in various plants throughout the area, but also to coastal communities. Just as an example, in 1984 was the first year that the sablefish fishery really took off in the Gulf of Alaska. And prior to that time, in Pelican, Alaska, a small little community about 90 miles from here, there would be no work at all during the winter months. As it turned out last year, there was full production for some 80 people or so, and that really provided an enormous benefit into the community. Very often, people just take a look at revenue provided directly as a result of the sale of the fish and think, well, that fishery is worth $15 million. But the fact is, there's a multiplier effect, and I think that we're using a multiplier effect of about 3. For every dollar of value of the fish, when it's sold, it yields 3 times as much to the community and to the state, and that's an important consideration to bear in mind. The issue of sablefish and the joint venture bycatch allocation is very complex, as everybody here is aware. I would make a comment that that perhaps you might want to note on your first be it resolved that you might want to define setting reserves aside in the central and western regulatory areas, and thus exclude the eastern regulatory area. There is no joint venture activity currently in the eastern regulatory area, and fine points like that sometimes come home to roost if we don't nail them in the beginning. I also received yesterday a copy of an issue statement from the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which does deal with the sablefish question, and I'll see that it's reproduced and made available to everybody. It begins to define the complexity of the issues and explain what the various alternatives are. One of the questions that has arisen as a result of the decision to allow a bycatch of sablefish to joint ventures is how's the bycatch handled? The Magnuson Fishery and Conservation Act states very clearly that when domestic fishermen can harvest 100% of the OI, that there shall not be an allocation to either joint ventures or to foreign processing vessels. In this case, I believe we're differentiating between joint ventures and another type of gear group, trawlers. But in order to make it clear, we call it joint ventures, but it is still an American fishery. When the joint ventures harvest their 10%, or whatever that amount is going to be, they are going to have to deliver it to some entity. And they are currently fishing with cod ends, which means that they detach the trawl and merely turn it over to a foreign factory ship, which is the partner in the joint venture, and they haul the trawl on board, empty the trawl, and there's all the product. So we find ourselves in a position where the foreign factory ship is actually going to be the vessel taking possession of the bycatch that is allocated to the joint venture. And that is, in my opinion, and I think in many other people's opinion, contrary to the Magnuson Act and probably illegal. Although, if the joint venture, if the foreign vessel merely gives the product back to the joint venture vessel, the actual fishing vessel, then it is an American product and can be taken into port. The only reason I bring this up is the council is going to be struggling with this at their February meeting and trying to determine to what extent they are going to allow the foreign processing vessel to handle this incidental catch. Are they going to allow the people on board that vessel to bleed it, to head it, to freeze it, to ice it down? And all of those things actually turn into processing. So I'd probably confused everybody, but the end result of it is that we, as a result of allowing the incidental catch to be taken by the joint venture vessels, we are almost as a matter of necessity, allowing foreign processing vessels to engage in the processing of a species of fish for which United States fishermen can harvest 100% of. And that is a big mistake. That's a concern that you might think about at some point. Another concern that looms on the horizon, and which I haven't really seen addressed in here, is that the council may very well allocate a certain bycatch of sablefish to foreign-directed fisheries in the Gulf and or in the Bering Sea. That is also supposed to be against the law because the American fisherman can harvest 100% of that particular species. But if we were to... If the council was to prohibit, as the law says, the taking of that species by the foreign fishing vessels, that would force them to cease fishing in any area where they have a bycatch of that species. So what they might do is they might turn around and allow either a bycatch or even set aside a portion of sablefish to be a actual directed fishery by the Ford fishing vessels. And that is terrible, because what it begins to do is it suggests that the provisions in the Magnuson Fishery and Conservation Act, which say American fishermen get first crack. If there's any left, it goes to joint ventures. If there's any left, it goes to foreign fishing, is totally out the window. What they would then be saying is that American fishermen get first crack, joint venture fishermen get second crack, but if foreign fishermen need some in order to continue their other fishery activities, then we're going to give them some from the American fishermen's portion. I call that transmutation, for what it's worth. Another concern, I don't want to drive everybody crazy here. I think Adelheid, Representative Herman, said that it was a complex issue. Another concern is that when you're dealing with federal fisheries, there is a management plan. The management plan sets how much can be harvested and so on and so forth. We are currently talking about allowing joint ventures to have a bycatch of sable fish in order for them to engage in their other fisheries. What happens when the longline sable fish fishermen have harvested the entire OI of sable fish, and then they want to go out and harvest cod, longline for cod, or longline for halibut if there's a late opening? If they are going to incidentally harvest more sable fish while they are longlining for other fish, then there is the possibility, the way the council has its plan established now, that they will not be allowed to engage in that fishery, even though it's a directed fishery on halibut or another part of the cod fishery. So to sum up, I hardly expect you to be able to incorporate all of these comments into a into this resolution and have it ready by the council meeting next week. But I think you're going in the right direction. It is a complex issue, and there's an awful lot at stake here. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify and hope I didn't confuse everybody too much.
Do you have a seat for the committee for the committee?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Did you mention that on page 2, line 7, that we could change it to say, and set aside reserves in the central and western
Gulf
regulatory
areas. Yeah.
Does anybody have any problem with that?
Madam Chairman, when it comes time to mark up the bill, I'll make that as a motion.
Is there any problem with that? The motion's on the table. All in favor? Or in the post? Hearing none.
That it goes on line 7, right after the word reserves, insert in the central and western regulatory areas.
That's correct.
Yes, I'll have to put that on the CS, and then when you vote on the CS, that'll be. Any questions of the witness?
May I make one more comment, Madam Chair? Very briefly. What we're also dealing with is in the long term, we're going to have a trawl fishery on bottom fish in the Gulf and in the Bering Sea. And as the trawl fishery develops, there is going to be gear conflicts. This is the first of the major gear conflicts that's coming before you. I am a very strong supporter of longline only. However, I think in response to a question that John, Representative Sund, asked of the previous person, regarding do you want a set amount or do you want a percentage amount, I think we have to bear in mind that as the fishery develops and we begin to harvest more and more pollock and things like that through a trawl fishery, there is bound to be an incremental increase in bycatch of other fisheries, and that is going to
the bill moved out of committee, will have the signatures. And now I'd like to go on to House Bill 7, which is my bill. And at this time, I will turn the chair briefly over to Representative, Co-Chairman Representative Schultz, and at this time, I'd like to testify on House Bill 7.
Yeah,
we have, or there are two other people to testify. Lots of fishermen have called me and Senator Zaroff and Colonel Henderson of the Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection about the problems of enforcing fishing regulations in Bristol Bay. This problem has gotten so bad that honest fishermen in my district are really getting hurt financially. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, so I'll give you a little background on it. Bristol Bay is the largest salmon fishery in the state. More than 80% of the sockeye salmon caught in Alaska are caught during 1 month in my district. Most of these are even caught in 1 week during the first week of July. There are approximately 2,700 limited entry permit holders in Bristol Bay, and the local people who fish there depend on the commercial fishery for most of their yearly cash income. Most of the illegal fishing happens because the fishermen think they can get away with it. If you turn to the map in the Fisherman's Journal article called Bandits in the Bay, and there's a paper clip on that note here, I'll show you some of the problems we have. The shaded area in the Sisters Milling is a milling area where the salmon that go up the different river systems in the bay swim around in a big circle before going through the fishing district and then heading up the river to spawn. This milling area is closed to fishing to protect the salmon, but there are reported to be many boats fishing illegally in that area. When you look at the fish ticket records to find out where fish have been caught during the past few years, you find that there has been a huge increase in the fish landed at Igigit. It really makes you wonder where these fish are coming from when the Nakmiqwijat system has many more fish that spawn in it than the Igigit river system has. If we give the Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection access to fish tickets, it won't solve this problem completely, but it will at least help them to figure out who the violators might be so they can begin to investigate these illegal fishermen. Often in Bristol Bay, we get two or three boats fishing with the same limited entry permit, and even people falsifying limited entry cards. I've also heard that some processes help these illegal fishermen by falsifying information on the fish ticket. Everywhere I went with the Special Committee on Fisheries in the last 2 years, fishermen were asking the state for more enforcement in both the crab and salmon fisheries. At a time when we were trying to save money in the operating budget, it seemed that the least we can do is to make our Fish and Wildlife Protection officers more efficient at doing their jobs by giving them the ability to look at fish tickets without having to get a court order. Often just knowing that Fish and Wildlife Protection has access to fish tickets and has planes and boats out patrolling the area is enough to stop some of these fishermen from breaking the law. I don't know if it's the same in other fishing districts, but the example in Lieutenant Seibel's memorandum to Commissioner Sundberg points out a serious case where a boat was fishing crab in a closed area. You all know how bad the decline in crab has been for so many of our Alaskan fishermen. The division was able to find this violation in Wimicore case only by having access to fish tickets. The bill doesn't cost the state anything. What it does is give to Fish and Wildlife Protection a more efficient way to enforce the laws which we work so hard to pass to protect both honest fishermen and the fisheries of the state. Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, this implies that the section was once in place and was somehow altered. When did that happen and why?
Last year, it was overlooked by, I never knew about it, and it went from Representative Fuller over to the Senate side, and there were some problems there, and they were going to tack it onto the bill. I guess what happened, right in the middle of the session, Fish and Wildlife Protection realized that it was going to be sunsetted, or, you know, I'm not sure if it was in the middle of the session or when, but they realized it was going to be sunsetted and then tried to tack it onto a bill that was passing through the legislative process, and it just didn't work out. Yeah, it's in the packet, and then there's information in there about the governor.
Oh, yeah.
No further questions, I'll call Colonel Seibel to question.
Madam Chairman, my name is Conrad Seibel. Last name is spelled S-E-I-B-E-L. I'm a lieutenant with the Department of Public Safety, Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection. In your packets, and I believe you spoke to it, you should have a letter from Commissioner Sundberg to Madam Chairman, reference this bill. I believe it was dated the 18th of January, and also a memorandum from myself to Commissioner Sundberg in reference to this bill. There are several pages there, and I won't read through those pages again. There's no need to save your time. I would like to focus on a couple points this morning concerning this bill. First of all, I believe that it is an established principle that to have effective and efficient resource management, there must also be effective and efficient enforcement of the laws promulgated to protect and conserve the fish and game resources. Resource enforcement is an integral part of a resource management scheme. Passage of HB 7 would be a positive step towards ensuring that our state's resource laws are effectively enforced. In previous testimony regarding this issue, there has been concern voiced that allowing our agency to have access to fish tickets would encourage leakage of the information contained on a fish ticket and therefore could be financially harmful to the fishermen. I want to assure the committee that our agency's enforcement officers have and will continue to treat the information gained strictly as confidential, evidentiary knowledge as is done in any investigation, any and all investigations. Any officer who would do less could be subject to reprimand, dismissal, and or possibly criminal charges being filed against them. A third point I want to make this morning, a pertinent fact to our point here, is that compared to Department of Fish and Game, Limit Entry, and Department of Revenue, who all have access or use fish tickets, our agency probably has the most stringent requirements for becoming a member of its department by the use of background investigations and polygraph. The public and commercial fishermen are coming to us and demanding that we do something about the misuse of limit entry permits and other major commercial fishing violations. Without probable cause, which often is obtained from the fish ticket information, our ability to serve the public is severely hampered. In summary, we believe that the most efficient and effective means of enforcing our state's laws for the protection and conservation of its fishery resources would be to allow our agency to have access to fish tickets and fish ticket information. HB 7 would give us a timely access, and therefore we support and strongly urge passage of this bill. Because of the importance of this bill to our agency, we recommend that according to AS 0110070, the legislature also include an effective date in this bill in order that may be enacted into law as soon as possible. And I'd like to add one comment, if I may. I personally feel that what started out to be a housekeeping matter back in 1972 with the transfer of Protection Division from Fish and Game to Public Safety has now, over the past few years, become an issue in the legislature. I've testified, I know I did last year, and I know I did about 3 years ago when this issue came up. Now I'm here before the legislature again. So in my mind, it was a housekeeping thing that was just simply overlooked back in 1972. And our division strongly urges that the legislature pass this bill. Thank you, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions for you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to include this. I'd like to call Kim Parker to testify.
Madam Chairman, I'm Ken Parker, Director of Commercial Fisheries, Department of Fish and Game. I have some brief statements here, and then I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have concerning this issue. By way of a little history on the Fish Ticket Access issue, AS 1605-815 was adopted by the legislature and became law in 1970. This did not affect Fish and Wildlife Protection at that time because they were a member of the Department of Fish and Game. In 1972, the Division of Fish and Wildlife Protection was transferred to the Department of Public Safety. That move had the effect of prohibiting their access to fish tickets unless they obtained a court order. Attempts were made to allow them access, but they were not successful until 1982, when they were allowed access for a 2-year trial period. Access was not continued after July 1, 1984. Fish tickets are a legal document that is used by the department to determine harvest data, such as amount, species, time, location, and gear type. It is used by fishermen to document its harvest and its sale, and by purchasers to document their purchases. Therefore, the information provided by fish tickets is very important from a biological standpoint for proper management of our fisheries and as a document to record business transactions. Fish tickets are completed by fishermen and other purchasers and submitted to the department. The department then compiles the catch data from the tickets and uses the information along with other data, such as escapement levels, to determine if fishing can occur or if it must be closed to conserve or to allocate or for allocation reasons. Therefore, it is imperative that fish tickets are submitted in a timely fashion and are complete and accurate. Poor reporting could result in an overharvest and result in loss of harvest in future years, or an underharvest, which results in loss in income to the industry. Fish tickets can also provide information on whether a fisherman has a valid CFEC permit or whether he is, in fact, the holder of a permit. Information on fish ticket is also used by regulatory agencies, such as the Board of Fisheries, to determine catch histories by user groups that are in turn used as one basis for allocated decisions. Commercial fishing is a very tightly controlled industry with many statutes and regulations that ensure the conservation of the resource and fair distribution of the harvest. Fish tickets are a very important tool in the enforcement of those laws. Potential violations to those laws may become apparent when fish tickets are submitted to and reviewed by the department. The ticket may be late, incorrect, or incomplete data may be included. They may show fishing took place during a closed period or location, that the harvester did not have the proper licenses or used illegal gear, etc. The ticket can also be used as additional evidence for violations that are observed in the field. When Fish and Wildlife Protection was a part of the department, fish tickets that evidence suspected violations were turned over to Fish and Wildlife Protection to investigate and cite if required. When they no longer had access except by court order, our department personnel had to step in and take over this enforcement duty. These staff are professional full-time biologists involved in the management of the fisheries and therefore have limitations on the amount of time that they can spend directed towards this specific kind of activity. This has resulted in a reduction of enforcement and a reduction in our management efficiency, both which reduces the state's ability to ensure conservation of the resource and fairness in the harvest distribution. Under the present system, with access by Fish and Wildlife Protection restricted, the department staff must play the role of the enforcement officer, in other words, make the case, when evidence of a suspected violation is observed. The staff person must conduct the investigation, issue the citation, and develop the case with the Department of Law and appear in court. It is not possible to determine at this time the time spent on this activity, but needless to say, it's probably significant. With enforcement having free access to fish tickets, this time could be spent on management of the fishery. During the trial period, 1982 through 84, the department staff did keep some records of Fish and Wildlife Protection access to fish tickets. Those records have been compiled and are available through Fish and Wildlife Enforcement. At no time did our staff observe anyone from the enforcement agency reviewing fish tickets to look for violations, a procedure that was of concern to some of the public. Rather, what occurred is that the department staff will observe a suspect ticket and turn it over to the enforcement officer for investigation. Fish and Wildlife Protection will request to review specific tickets for evidence of violations they are already investigating as a result of observations or reports. In summary, Madam Chairman, the department is very supportive of HB 7, and we see a number of benefits accruing as a result of public safety having access to the fish ticket records.
Thank you.
Thus far, I've heard nothing but favorable commentary on this. Why would someone not want this?
I think the major opposition that has surfaced in past years was a concern that enforcement officers would simply review fish ticket files with the intent of identifying any kind of possible violation, and that concerned some groups of fishermen. In my statement, I indicated that the legislature was concerned about it when they allowed the trial period for 2 years, and as a result, the department and public safety worked together to monitor exactly the kind of access that occurred, and we simply didn't see that situation develop. That usually enforcement officers would observe something in the field, and then they would go to request a specific landing record for a vessel or an individual to see if perhaps a violation occurred. So the fish ticket was used as a supportive document, in other words. But we didn't see, of course, when we're reviewing fish tickets and entering them into our catch compilations, we have to go through the fish ticket to verify that all the fields are filled in correctly, the data is accurate for that particular fishery. And in doing that, we frequently run across items of question, and if it looks like it's a violation, then we would be turning it over to enforcement to pursue. Without them having access, of course, our biologists would have to go through the legal procedures to cite.
If for the benefit of the committee, I'm having a lot of enforcement problems in my district, and, you know, fish tickets is just like the core of it, but you'll be hearing more about, you know, what we're trying to do for enforcement, because there's a lot lacking.
I just wanted to make a statement, Madam Chairman, if I may. Coming from an area that's highly dependent on fishing, quite frequently fishermen think that the fish ticket is strictly their business, not anybody else's. And this is where I think our protest comes from, against this type of thing, allowing agencies to look at the fish tickets. That they think it's strictly between them and the processor, and that no one else has a right, which to me is a very misguided viewpoint.
Madam Chairman, I'd follow up on that. It's the fundamental problem that we face with all the fisheries. It's a common property resource, and we tend to forget that all of us own it until it's caught. And managing the common property resources. This is the last of the commons left in the world, and that's where all the fights come from, and that's the basis for all the debate you'll hear for the next 2 years here. So I agree with Representative Cato that it's not the fish is not owned by the fisherman. He has the right to catch it, and at the point of capture, it's his, but there has to be an enforcement mechanism in our a mechanism in place to figure out who's catching what. This is probably a needed piece of legislation.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. At this time, I'll entertain a motion to amend the bill, the amendment before you.
You do. Everyone has a copy of an amendment in front of them, and there is no objection. I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent to adopt that amendment for House Bill 7.
Hearing no objections, so moved. At this time, I'll entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee.
Thank you. I'd move and ask unanimous consent that we pass from the Resources Committee House Bill 7 as amended.
Unanimous consent has been asked for. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, at this time, if we could have the bill passed around, each of us sign most bills, and Representative Schultz mentioned that there will be no Resource Committee meeting tomorrow. Oh, Friday. That's right. No further business coming before the committee. The committee meeting is adjourned at 9:30.
Madam Chairman, just a couple of points of comment. I believe there's an overview hearings on oil and gas and Senate resources today.
Yes.
I would encourage.
There's one Friday also. Those
the oil and gas committee one. Meeting is meeting on Friday at 3:30, but I would encourage those of you who can attend, oil and gas is another very complicated area. Chairing the Senate resources is Senator Sturgeluski, and then oil and gas will be Representative Davis, but the committee meetings have been announced. And for those of you who didn't get enough black cod or sable fish today, it is in the lounge, available for you to feast on all day.
It is delicious, too.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm waiting for a crab bill so that we get king crab.
We're working on it. We're working on it. We'll expect that king crab from Kodiak this time.
Black cod. You know, I couldn't grab sable fish to save my life. Because in Valdez we call it black cod.
Well, they're trying to change the name because black cod sounds so gungy. It's like,
oh, John.
It's like a mud fish.
Truth
or something.
John, one of our processors in Prince William Sound just got the first market for gray cod. See hot seafoods? Just got the first market.
Well, we've been salting gray cod for a while, but I hope we've got a good one.
I mean fresh.
Good.
They're really going to town and see hot.
Yeah, it makes excellent lutefisk.
Yeah. By the way, Roger, don't you say hello anymore?
How are you?
I haven't seen you for ages, though. Where have you been?
This is like old home week around here at the fishery. I was going to
say.
Yeah. Larry can't remember what side of the fence we're on.
No. I know.
Well, these were pretty easy, so we'll get caught in some pickle.
Yeah,
we need to. We'll get caught in some fine time to tie in.
Yeah. Rosemary Alexander's on her way over here. Is she going to come to this room? Yes. Okay.
When are you going to
come to the gym?
Sure. Yeah. Hey.
I was there last night.
I know, and I was.
I
had the.
I gave him help.